Welcome back to the American Revolution podcast. We are now at episode 75, the Mohawk Campaign. So, in the last set of episodes, we talked about the Battle of Bennington, the first of four possible turning points in the American Revolution. Okay, so now, we are moving west. Why are we moving west? Well, if you remember back a few episodes, we were discussing Burgoyne's plan. He laid out this very elaborate plan. He's going to move south from Canada along the Hudson River, and he's going to take Albany. It was a three-pronged plan. He's going to come down from the north. Howe is going to come from the south, from New York, and then there was a third force. Well, with Bennington, we had mentioned that, well, that was it. There was no Howe coming. He had a plan to go to Philadelphia, so Burgoyne is on his own. But Burgoyne had reinforcements coming. Colonel Barry St. Ledger was moving from Oswego down the Mohawk River Valley to meet Burgoyne around Albany. Now, the Mohawk River was going to be key to the British plan, and it's for two reasons. First, because it's the frontier of the New York colony, and the frontier zones are, as we are going to see in future episodes, some of the bloodiest fighting you're going to find. There's lots of Tory support in some pockets, and then there's lots of Patriot support in others. So now we're going to see in the Mohawk Valley, well, we have families like the Johnsons and the Butlers. I haven't really covered them too much, but they're great allies of the Iroquois. They're very friendly settlers out there. They work with Joseph Brant, who is leader of, who's a war chief for the Iroquois nations. Okay? They're Tories. But then we have other commanders like Herkimer, who we are going to begin talking about in this episode as well, who are Patriots that are ready to stop the British at all costs. So, we have this pocket, these pockets of Tory support, which they're going to utilize. But now we also have a second factor to think about. And that's in the Mohawk Valley. We're looking at almost like a central hub, a central point. It's almost like a doorway to the Iroquois Confederacy. Now, originally, the Iroquois Confederacy spread all across New York and into parts of Vermont and into New Jersey and Pennsylvania and all of that. But that was, and if you read the history books, it either happened about 500 years earlier or 800 years earlier. It's somewhere in that zone when these two. It's very weird. If you look at the history books, it says, you know, the Iroquois Confederacy started around either 1142 or 1400. I'm sorry, guys, but you need to narrow that stuff down for me because almost a 400-year difference in between the two. You're like, hello? What's happening here? So we have no idea. So I average it out and I say about 500 years ago, five nations got together and said, we are going to join together. Another pocket is added, and that's the Tuscaroras. Or the Cayugas. I don't remember. And I'm sorry for the little aside. But either the Tuscaroras or the Cayugas were the last ones to join it. I don't remember who it was. Doesn't matter. There's actually a podcast devoted to the Iroquois. You should look it up. But getting back to where I was, the Iroquois Confederacy is really central in the Mohawk Valley. In the Mohawk Valley, well, you have the Mohawk Indians. You have Onondagas, Cayugas, Senecas, Oneidas, and the Tuscaroras. This was one of the largest groups of Indians that you would find in the Northeast. So the American Revolution didn't just follow Washington's army or the Northern army. We're going to be looking into that country. We're going to look at this neighbor versus neighbor fighting. We're going to look at the impact that the war has on the Indians, because we are going to definitely be talking a little bit more about the impact of the Indian or the war has on the Indians. The British sought support from their loyal subjects as well as the Indians, and they wanted to use the Indians as a force on the frontier. Here's the thing. The British knew what they were doing. They were preparing to unleash a terrible force upon the Mohawk River Valley, and it came in the form of the Six Nations. Now, in Tryon County, which is in upstate New York, where we are going to start our story, and the Mohawk along the Mohawk River. This is an epicenter. The vast river valley was home to some 5,000 people from all over Western Europe. They, like the frontiers of America, were divided. For the better part so far, Tryon County was considered to be a Tory stronghold. The most powerful family in the area were the Johnsons, and they also had a good relationship with the Butlers, which were another Tory family. And these families had great relationships with the Indians. Until his death in 1774, Sir William Johnson was the Director of Indian Affairs for the Crown. His son-in-law, Colonel Guy Johnson, will assume that post after his death. Both sides, Patriot and British alike, wanted the support of the Indians. And so the Six Nations got together in August of 1775. At the Great Council Fire in Albany, the Confederacy voted to stay out of the conflict, calling it a family matter. Now, this is key. They call it a family matter, British versus British. They didn't see a difference between American and British. They were all Europeans. They were all English. In most cases. And they all say, well, this is a family matter. You guys need to sort this stuff out. This doesn't hold for four of the tribes. They decide that they're going to stick with the British. And that's the Mohawk, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas. The Oneidas and the Tuscaroras are going to stay out of it. They want to not be a part of the fighting. They're going to hold true. But they do lean to the support of the Americans, and that's thanks to a man named Samuel Kirkland, who is a missionary that was very close with both tribes. They're not going to fully support the American cause, but they are also not going to support the British. Now, the Johnsons and the Butlers, as I said, were an influential Tory family in the area, and at the onset of the war, Schuyler had ordered General Herkimer with the county militia to go and get Sir John Johnson, who was the son of William Johnson, and take him as prisoner. Well, when that happens, the rest of the Tories completely left and head to Canada. But they're going to return. And that happens in the summer of 1777. They're part of the British expedition to the Mohawk Valley. So now we've kind of jumped back in time a little bit. Now we're bringing it back forward. Key players. Walter Butler and Guy Johnson. And John Johnson as well. They are going to be key Tory leaders. Joseph Brant, a war chief for the Iroquois Nation, is going to also be a key player. Now, let's look at the Mohawk Valley itself. The principal defense in the valley was Fort Stanwyck. Built in 1758, it sported bomb-proof bastions. It had covered barracks and a large picketed ditch. But, like all of our forts that we have talked about, well, after 20 years, being removed from the French and Indian War, it has fallen apart. It's a complete shell from what it used to be. Colonel Peter Gainsvoort of the 3rd New York Continentals is the man who is in charge of taking over this fort. He is quoted as saying, "The fort is not only indefensible, but untenable. There's no way we can hold it." But he had a job to do, and Gainsvoort and his second-in-command, Lieutenant Colonel Marinus Willett, they're competent and energetic officers. So they're going to go and make this fort, defensible again. No matter the condition, the fort had to be taken before any force could move down the valley to the Hudson. So they know it. So the commanding officer knows it. We have to make this fort somewhat somewhat prepared for a possible invasion, because They have to take the fort. So if we can do it, if we can do it and put this fort together, we could possibly hold the valley. Not only do the officers know it, but Barry St. Ledger also knows it. Now, we mentioned before that Barry St. Ledger was the man who was chosen for the job. Normally a lieutenant colonel, he's brevetted a brigadier general. I know in different episode, different portions of episodes, I've referred to him as Colonel Barry St. Ledger. This was information that I actually dug up in a in one of my other readings. He goes from a lieutenant colonel with the 43rd Regiment of Foot to he's given the field command of brigadier general. It means he's brevetted, which means that you get the rank and title, but we're not going to pay you the general rate. So for right now, he's got the rank and the title. It's just to make sure that he is the most powerful man on the field. That's kind of what brevetting does. Anyway, vocabulary lesson aside, there will not be a test. He's brevetted a brigadier general. He has a combined force that he was outfitted by Burgoyne, remind you, of 875. He had 200 British troops, 130 Tories, 350 Jaegers, a unknown number of Canadian irregulars and axemen. Their numbers were varying because they're irregular troops, so they're militia, but they're also the axemen were non-combatants, so their number was varied. So if I do quick math, there were probably somewhere about 150 or so Canadians in his group. Along with that, he had 40 artillerymen who were to man 2 6-pound field guns, 2 3-pound field guns, and 4 Coehorn mortars. Now, for those who are not up to date with their American Revolution artillery handbook, a Coehorn mortar is a very small mortar. It launches something between a 3 and probably 7-pound projectile. They come in varying sizes, but basically they are not these large mortars that have to be moved with a crew and everything. Basically, two guys on either end can lift it up and run it anywhere on the field. And that's what he has to work with. He's going to use these little mortars against the fort. Well, that's not going to do it. And we're going to talk about the siege at another time. But who else is with these 875 men? Well, that's Joseph Brant. He has 1,000 Indians, and they are all in support of the British Army. So that means moving against Gainsborough at Fort Stanwyck is 1,875 men. 875 British and 1,000 Indians. This is one of the larger forces we will see when talking about a battle on the frontier during the American Revolution. This is going to be a very bloody and decisive battle that we are going to talk about next episode. Now, on July 26th, this 1,800-man force would make their way to Fort Stanwyck. It was thought to be a dilapidated mess with a mere garrison of 60 men, so they planned to take it very quickly. But that's something we're going to have to discuss next time. For right now, we're going to cut this episode. We're going to end this episode. We are going to go on to next episode. We are going to discuss the Battle of Oriskany, and I'm going to do a little bit more discussion of the backstory of Gainsborough and Herkimer and the fort itself. This episode was really to set the pieces, set the stage. Gainsborough is in Fort Stanwyck. He is going to be marched against by Brigadier General St. Ledger and Joseph Brant with 1,000 Indians. Okay? Herkimer is going to figure into this, but we're going to talk about him next episode. Now, I do want to thank everyone for their patience and their understanding. My training and, you know, summer school and everything I'm doing for my teaching is just, you know, it's just a mess. And I don't get a lot of time to write podcasts. And I've had some time, probably the last weekend, to really do a good bit of writing. And I got to get a couple of episodes ahead. So I have two right now that I'm ready. So we are going to move forward. Hopefully, you know, next week I'll have another episode out, and the week after that, I'm hoping that I can just keep this nice flow going. But before I talk too much, I want to just end the episode here and say that next week there will be a discussion on the Battle of Oriskany. A little house cleaning. Please, if you are using the iTunes or iTunes podcast app or whatever you're doing to get a hold of episodes of this podcast, please go on iTunes and give me a 5-star, you know, do the 5-star thing, you know, leave some comments. Doing that is going to boost when they say, hey, check out this podcast to people, you know, I'm going to get more support that way from iTunes. It's really helpful. If you're doing it through some other means or methods, completely understand. But I do appreciate people using the Facebook. The Facebook is also there for your use. So I'm really happy people are using that. To end this episode, I want to just draw everyone's attention. I haven't done it in a while. And I have been starting it in the last few episodes, giving book reviews. And the most recent one I've been working on, and I'm not finished reading it, but I am very familiar with the man and his exploits, but that Thaddeus Kosciuszko, Military Engineer of the American Revolution, by Francis Kazimierz Kujenskik. So if I probably completely butchered that name, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a photo. I'm going to start putting photos up on the Facebook again of these of the books that I'm using. This way everyone can see. This book is fantastic. I haven't finished it yet, but I am well on my way, and it really does a great job of, one, talking about his time working in the Northern Department as the engineer, but more importantly, it talks about his life, and it does such a good job, really does a good job about covering his life and career, not only before the war, but after. Quite a fantastic book, very interesting. Okay, I'm sorry for the long-winded stuff at the end of the episode. I will try and cut that down for future reference. But that'll do it for us this week. So I want everyone to have a great week. Be safe, and as always, keep your powder dry.